Back to school means shopping for supplies, which can mean different things to different people. Pencils, a new backpack. What about a bra? If you have never been that awkward age where you needed a bra but couldn't get one on your own, I'm here to tell you it's uncomfortable even under the best circumstances. Even if the only obstacle is an awkward conversation, that's plenty. But if you add a financial barrier to the mix, it's even worse. Bras are not cheap, and going to school without this particular school supply can be a really embarrassing problem to have. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to learn about the local movement to support young girls across the economic spectrum with bras that fit in time for school. Tiffany Price is the founder of Hold 'Em Up for Care. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi.
So the issue is not funny, but the name of your organization kind of is.
It just popped into my head randomly. I was sitting there and I was like, oh, Hold 'Em Up for Care. I was like, well, if you think about it, you're holding them up.
So for real.
That's where it came about. And so I Googled it to make sure nobody else used it. And the only thing that came close to hold them up was for poker.
What got you thinking about the issue of bras for teenagers to begin with?
I'm a part of PLTI, which is Parent Leadership Training Institute, and so everybody in the cohort had to do a community project. My original project was a mentoring program for boys and girls, and so in the midst of planning that, it just popped into my head. I was like, oh, girls need bras.
What made you, like, was there something in your own personal frame of reference that made you think, you know what, there's something going on here?
Yes, definitely. And my family, a lot of my younger cousins, they're big busted. They're bustier girls. And so just looking at them, realizing how they wear sweatshirts or hoodies or double bras, I was like, okay, something needs to be done. And so that's the real movement behind it.
A lot of people wear sweatshirts and hoodies. What was it about the way they were wearing them that made you think this isn't like just a fashion statement?
The first thing, it was in the summer. So I was like, why are you wearing a sweatshirt and it's 90 degrees outside? And so she gave me an odd look and I was like, oh, your breast. And she was like, yeah. And so it's more so as a cover up to me, something that they're ashamed of. And instead of being ashamed of something, it's like they need the self-confidence to embrace their breast. And so that's what the real thing behind it is.
What made you think this was an issue just beyond your own family and one that might affect some communities more acutely than others?
When I was thinking about myself growing up, I never had the conversation of, okay, well, what bra do you need? It was, she went and bought them, I wore them, that was it. And so as me as a grown person, if I wasn't measured until I was an adult, just think about how many other girls were going through the same thing. And because I was, as they consider, a normal size, what about the ones that's not a normal size? And so it's like bras are so expensive. If they can't even have a conversation to say, I need a bra, then how are they going to have a conversation to say, I need a good bra?
So I'm thinking about the listeners who do not have breasts and right. Therefore, like, maybe have never worn a bra, don't know really what it is we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And I want to help them understand. First of all, when you talk about quote unquote normal sizes and then being outside of that, mm-hmm. Can you explain what that means?
The normal size, as I've researched, is 32B or 32C. Well, for
two sizes are normal?
Yes.
Okay.
In that range.
Go on.
And so for people that are on the heavier side, I would say not even the band size, not the number size, but the cup size.
So I'm going to also explain that. The band size is the part that goes around your rib cage.
Correct.
And then the cup size is like what
the
you're filling
size.
Out. Yeah.
And so C's and above, that starts being on the bustier side. So those cost more because it's more support. And so for people that don't have to wear bras or never worn a bra, well, thank you. It's a lot of money being saved. But for the people that do wear bras or, you know, have to wear a bra, it's a lot of money involved. It's a lot of self-confidence involved. And so
can you also describe what it's like to not have the right size of bra, why that matters?
It matters a whole lot. the first thing that I noticed is that as far as the girls being in school, I don't want a girl to be labeled as a problem child because she's fidgety at her desk or she can't concentrate or, you know, she's irritated because her bra may be too small, the straps are cutting into her skin, or she's just uncomfortable all around. And so instead of them being labeled as a problem child, it's like, well, let's get them bras to at least fix this issue. And so if we can fix the issue of them having support for bras, then I think it'll change. Well, I don't think, I know it would change their self-confidence. And then for the girls to play sports, if they can't afford a sports bra, they're missing out on their God-given talents, which could be also life-altering. And so that's another issue that I hope to solve.
So how did you go from being a person who noticed a need to being a person who was doing something about it?
Well, I as in part of PLTI, they was like, it's all about the media and how you put your story out there. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm on Facebook. I have 5,000 friends. I can start, you know, sharing everything. Then it's like, well, you need to be on all social media platforms. And so Twitter is where I say I made my breakthrough, because on Twitter, when you're tweeting, you can add anybody. And so I was just tweeting and adding everybody. I was like, okay, well, I watch the newscast all the time, so I'm going to tweet them and the radio stations and everybody. And the Sarah Platt from KSHB, she noticed, and she's like, oh, you know, I want to know more about your organization. And so I told her, and they did a news story March 6th, and it has blossomed from there.
How does it work? How do you get the donations? How do you get them to people who need them?
Oh, gosh, the donations, the community, well, not even just the community, because I received donations from out of town as well. They have been so great. I have a drop-off location at Close Mentor in Overland Park. If people couldn't get them dropped off there, they'll send me a message and they'll actually physically mail them to me. I've met people to pick up donations. And so most people, they just reach out, they donate. Dillard's, all three of the local Dillard's, they partner with me and they collect the donations. And so once they reach a certain number, I go out and I pick them up from them. For service in the community, the best resource is to email me at holdemupforcare. And so we'll set up a date and time for them to be measured and fitted. And then after that, they will be serviced as far as me providing them with the bras.
This is hard to talk about for girls, especially girls at this age where their bodies are still in the process of changing. All of this is new. They are not yet comfortable with this part of themselves. My mom for sure tried to talk to me about all of this stuff, and I was mortified and did not allow it. So if it's hard to talk about bras with the people closest to you, how do you start up a conversation with the public, with girls you've never met?
Well, that part was actually easy. 2 weeks ago, I did Fresh Cuts, Fresh Starts, and I was in the girls only zone. And so I had two groups of girls, different ages. And so the first question I asked was, so who wears bras? And then I was like, so who knows about bras? And so I just engaged with them from there. And I was like, well, if you don't have breasts, you may or may not get them one day. And so that's just how you open up. It's just like an icebreaker. Well, who knows about bras? Oh, well, I do. Okay. Well, so we just go from there. And so once they see that one person is talking or they see that they're not by themselves, they tend to open up more freely.
Do you think maybe it is easier when it's not like your immediate family member?
It is. I think it was easier because they were not alone. It was something that they were all able to relate to.
Call 816-235-2888. If you have a story or insight into what happens when bras get overlooked or just aren't in the budget when it comes time for school supplies, 816-235-2888. We'd especially love to hear from teachers. 816-235-2888. I have a youth with me now. Libby Price is 20 now.
Hello.
Hello. And you went to Raytown High School, right?
Yes.
And you're Tiffany's cousin.
Yes.
Tell me your story, how you got involved.
She actually brought the idea to the older girls in our family, and I actually liked it because she was the first one to ever buy me the correct size bra, which wasn't cheap. It was probably like $30 to $40.
Well, can you take me back? How old are you at this time?
Probably like 15, 16. Mm-hmm. So, and it was freshman year. And I actually was a cheerleader, and we needed the correct size bra, you know, with going to cheer camp and working out and doing all the activities that come with cheer. So in order for my uniform to fit correctly, I needed the proper undergarment. So that was...
And your cousin approached you about this?
Yeah, she was like, are you wearing double bra? And I was like, I have to. I don't have, you know, just one bra that fits the correct way. And so she was like, okay, well, we're going to go get you fitted. And
I want to slow this story down a bit. You figured out, in the absence of a bra that fit, you figured out how to combine two bras to give you the support you needed.
Yes.
Yeah, you're a genius.
Sounds crazy. So because I had the right cup size, but I didn't have the right band size. So I would wear a sports bra over the regular padded bra so I can have the support around, you know. So she took me to Lane Bryant to get measured and fitted, and she actually bought my bra, and I wore it till I couldn't wear it anymore. So
what was that like for you? How did that change things?
It actually made me feel better about my chest, because my mom would be like, well, I used to be that big when I was your age too. And I was just like, but I have to wear two bras and it's uncomfortable sometimes and I don't like it. So
it made you feel differently about yourself.
I felt confident. I didn't have to always wear a jacket. I could just put on my cheer uniform and go about my day, and I didn't feel like it was too much up top. So it felt good.
You have been involved since then in some of the fittings.
Yes.
In the events.
Yes.
Tell me about those from your perspective. Describe what happens and what you've noticed.
Okay, July, actually before that, we raised money and donations, and I loved it. It was, we had drummers come out to draw attention to cars driving by. We were standing on the corner. I don't know what street was it?
It was 63rd.
On 63rd Street. And we raised a lot of donations. A lot of people slowed down and came in, gave money, dropped off bras. Some people were like, well, I'm going to leave, go get some and come back. That was the first event that I had participated in. The second event was the actual Hold 'Em Up for Care event, which was July 13th, 2019. And we had to be there really early, but it was fun. A lot of girls found their correct size. Some of them already knew their size, but wanted to make sure, so they got measured anyway. It was a lot of help.
What did you notice about the girls who were finding out their size for the first time?
They were kind of surprised, like, I wear this size? Like, you know, someone was like, that sounds big, but in actuality, it wasn't. It was just like right, just the right correct size. So
from a health standpoint, this actually matters quite a bit, right, Tiffany?
Correct.
Talk to me about that.
Well, the biggest thing is the self-confidence. When you eliminate them feeling horrible about themselves, that eliminates some health, some mental health issues. As far as having the proper breast support, it eliminates some back issues. Also teach the girls how to do correct breast exams. So therefore, they can have early detection, because just like I explained to them, you're with your body every day, all day. So if you start doing the breast exams, then you'll notice something before somebody else notices something. And so therefore, I was like, if you notice something, I say, just like, hey, mom, I've been doing these breast exams and something just feels different. You know, maybe it's something we need to be to get checked out. So I figured if the girls have the right bras, then it will eliminate a lot of talks about the surgery. Because if you can have a conversation with a girl about a surgery, why you just can't take them to have a conversation about getting the right bra?
You know, I want to get to our callers in just a second at 816.
Oh, we have callers.
Yes, we do. 816-235-2888. But before I do, so we're having this conversation on the radio, and I think that might be uncomfortable for some people. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how we make issues that face girls and women specifically every single day of their lives, not just girl stuff that we aren't allowed to talk about in mixed company, but real issues mm-hmm. that affect real people and require conversation and systematic solutions, which means talking about it.
Right.
How do you break through that? Sort of the novelty factor, too, of like, it's the temptation to have sort of a giggly conversation
right.
about it.
The way that I look at it is, would you prefer to have the conversation or would you prefer for them to hear it somewhere else? And even if you don't feel comfortable, do you have like maybe another female figure that you know, are comfortable with having the conversation? Or it could be something that you can take to the school, like, hey, you know, the girls are going through changes at this age or maybe before this age. Is it something that the school provides for, you know, them to have the conversations, or just start a girls group or maybe write a note and have the girls write a note and...
But is it important for men to be able to be part of this conversation?
It definitely is. I came across a lot of men who realized, like, oh, I didn't know that, you know, bras were so important. I just normally give them my card or write the check and, you know, and have them bras. It was like I never realized how much of an issue it was for the girls to have bras. And so even if they aren't comfortable with going to buy the bras, then it should be definitely something that they can be aware of.
It strikes me that boobs are kind of a taboo subject for polite conversation, but
right.
so is money, so is class, so is economic struggle. It's like you've combined two things that people carry a lot of shame about, and you're out there trying to talk about both at once,
mm-hmm.
which really impresses me.
Oh, thank you.
But how do you do it? And what do you notice about when you try?
The biggest thing that I notice is it's nothing to be ashamed about. If you don't have the money to buy... you know, the bras for the girls, that's why we have this organization to, you know, to offer that lending hand. It's nothing to be ashamed about. You know, everybody needs help no matter what their status is. As far as the breasts, it's nothing to be ashamed about. It's something that we were born with. It's something that needs to be embraced, and it's a conversation that needs to be had. And so it's like, okay, well, bras and money, it ties together. There's nothing wrong with it.
Let's talk to our callers at 816-235-2888. Joy in Kansas City, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you want to share?
Well, it's funny that this show came on today. Yesterday, my husband actually was bra shopping with me, and he never realized it was so hard to find the right size bra, and he actually realized yesterday that it's going to be hard for our daughter to find one. So we were shopping because my son, he has special needs, and we finished breastfeeding him 2 years ago, but we've been stuck at home kind of helping him with some special needs, and now he's kind of ready to fly on his own. So I'm ready to get a job again, and so I'm no longer a 34M like I was when we were breastfeeding, but now I'm a 34G. And we went to Lane Bryant and were measured and everything. And for one, the cost was crazy. We're a family living under federal poverty level. And two, they didn't actually have a cup size that was as large as what I am. And so they were telling me, you know, maybe you should shop online and then send them back. But if I want to go and start interviewing for jobs like this week, next week, then I have to just wear my maternity bras, which don't fit right. And so there's wideness around elbow length, like elbow
level.
It's hard
to look professional
on my body. Right. You can't look professional when you look like you're, you know, the way you do when you stay at home.
And you're bringing up something we're talking about when bodies change when you're very young. It happens. It doesn't just stop there. You aren't the same size for life.
Right. Well, and you don't have the same size for life. But if we can start kids thinking about, you know, what it's like to be a woman and what that means for your changes in the practical uses of their breasts, and like that's a beautiful, awesome thing that provides life to other people, that they can love that about them, and maybe that will change people. Maybe somebody will be inspired and design fashions that exemplify a breast that hangs lower than chest, like shoulder level.
Thank you so much for your call, Joy.
And thank you so much to the person who's the leader of the organization, because my daughter is going to need your services in like 4 years. And it means so much.
You know, Joy, I also wonder, it sounds like maybe there's a need for this kind of service beyond school years.
There might be, because you were talking about cheer practices, they happen in the summer. You know, their conditioning happens in the summer. And so, you know, the need for a sports bra might happen like when they start practices up in the end of May or something.
Well, Joy, thank you so much for your call and good luck in your job search and in your bra search.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let's talk also with Nancy. Nancy is calling us from Overland Park. Hi, Nancy.
Hey there. I also am so glad you're talking about this. It's fantastic. And you mentioned before all the people in our society without breasts. And I wanted to shout out a challenge to all the men out there. This is not just a women's problem. It matters in all of our society. Like you said, girls having confidence and the ability to focus at school, women in the job search, in the workplace. It's a part of life. And all those men out there who've never had the hassle and expense of buying a bra, if each one of you male listeners out there today would send in the price of a bra, $25 or $30, like on the low end, that would make such a huge difference to allowing these girls to really blossom the way that they should.
You know, okay, Nancy, thank you for this call. I also want to say when she gives the dollar amount of $25 to $30, we've already kind of touched on this, but I want to really explicitly like make sure it's clear that bras cost different amounts depending on what size they are, in part because at a place like a general kind of store like Target or Walmart, someplace where you might find everyday needs at a decent price, though those stores aren't going to have sizes that are outside what someone somewhere has deemed quote unquote normal.
Correct.
A lot of us are not in those size ranges.
Right, correct.
Okay. So just wanted to make that clear.
Absolutely correct.
That dollar amount is very much on the low end. Libby, break down for me what you think has been achieved in the time you've been working on Hold 'Em Up for Care and what needs to be done now that you haven't quite been able to tackle yet.
I just keep asking questions about when is the next event? Are you going to expand? How long are you going to? Because I want to participate in every single event. I love helping people. I love helping people find the things that they need. So my volunteer work is not just, oh, for me to be doing something. I actually care about it. I want to help more girls because she helped me. So I'm passing it on to help someone else. And it actually excites me to see people outside that attended those events like, oh, I was at your event. Or I was at your cousin's event. You know, that excites me. And I just want them to pass it on to someone else as well.
What are your thoughts, Tiffany, about what still needs to be done?
I'm tearing up. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
The needs is, always replenishing the products that we give out. It's also as far as I'm still in the process of flying out on my own to get my 501c3. Right now I am being... it's not sponsored, but I'm up under someone else's until I can branch out on my own. And so that's a big need. Just donations as far as being able to place to hold the events, like donation space, just the general stuff to hold an event. And so it's just the donations as far as the bras and the supplies.
Tiffany Price, Libby Price, thanks so much for talking with us
today.
Thank
you for having us.
Thank you.
Tiffany started Hold 'Em Up for Care, an organization trying to get fitting bras for girls who can't afford them. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And when we return, we'll be talking about the local legacy of Toni Morrison. Stay tuned.
I was eager to read about a story where racism really hurts and can destroy you.
That's the voice of Toni Morrison. That was from a New York Times video that came out when the Nobel Prize winning author died earlier this month at the age of 88. It's been weeks since she died, and the public remembrances have not slowed down. In fact, there's one scheduled for this weekend at the Black Archives of Mid-America here in town. It'll be a celebration of Toni Morrison's life and her work. Books will be on hand so people can take turns reading favorite passages aloud. This is all to say that in an age of RIPs on Facebook that come and go, show at a frenzied pace, this one is different, and we're here to talk about why with personal stories from the people hosting and organizing these events. Mary Emma Graham is an English professor who runs KU's Project on the History of Black Writing, and she is also a past president of the Toni Morrison Society. Hello, Mary Emma.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We are going to talk a lot today, and we're going to dig a lot deeper. But to start this off, if you had to sum up in just a few sentences what Toni Morrison means to you personally, what would you say? What's the first thing?
I'd say giving us that deep, deep dive into the Black experience over time. We can't escape a certain kind of history, much of which was hidden, and I think Morrison brought it into the open, but she was talking and writing to Black people. Everybody else could hear it and see it and read it, but she was talking essentially and thinking through the experience of Blackness. She made it okay for us to talk about whiteness and Blackness.
Glenn North is also here. He is a poet. He's the director of public programs at the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center. Glenn, how would you answer that same question? First, top of mind, like Toni Morrison matters because...
Well, she provides an example. For me as a writer, her ability to express herself in her Blackness unapologetically has been an example that I've tried to follow since I became aware of her work. And her fearlessness and her mastery have all given me inspiration to try to, in my lane, of course, achieve some of those same things.
Natasha Elscari is our third guest this morning. She is also a poet. She's a gallery owner. She hosted a Toni Morrison reading a couple weekends ago. Hi, Natasha.
Good morning.
And so what for you, what's at the heart of your relationship with Toni Morrison and Toni Morrison's writing?
I feel like for me, it's a personal entry. She's like a literary grandmother. If I were to combine my grandmother's and the deep love and advice and kind of talking to they gave me, she's the literary version of that and an example for Black women writers on how they can live their life.
Can you give me an example of a moment where you found yourself reading and feeling like you were getting a personal talking to?
Definitely. In one of my favorite texts would be Song of Solomon, when Pilate is talking to Hagar about, you know, Guitar not loving her. And when she's like, how can he not love you? The same hair that grows between his legs grows between yours. The same hair that grows on his head grows out of yours. How could he not love you? And this idea around, you know, bringing each other out of the slumps of life. She talks a lot about that, about sisterhood, about, you know, multi-generational things. And so I think through her female characters, which were so varied, from incredibly prissy and pristine to women who hid out in swamps and didn't come out, and like all the ways that they dealt with life. So I feel like I can always pull from whichever character that I want to be in that moment. You know, if I want to be the pristine person that is like unmoved in public, or if I want to just wreck shop, that I actually have permission to do that in response to the things that I experience in this country.
It's like the cast of characters is also a cast of mentors.
Yes.
Call 816-235 is the number, 2888. If Toni Morrison and her writing changed you or just left you with something that you hold really dear, 816-235-2888. Natasha, what did you witness at the reading you hosted? What kinds of things were people coming to express or do?
What was so beautiful about the reading is that it was about 17, between 15 and 17, all women, and every single generation, because we had a one-year-old there all the way to an elder there that was 75 years old. So we had every decade represented. I don't know if we had 30s, but we had like 20s and 40s and 50s, 60s, 70s, and then below 10. And what was beautiful to watch was how people responded so personally to whatever it was that they loved, whether it was the language itself and her mastery of the English language, or whether it was her dialogue and the way the characters interacted with each other. We talk about her mastery of language, but we don't really talk about her mastery of Black English, mm-hmm. and Black language. Like, she is like to translate what you're hearing into the written word and to float between those two, that double consciousness that we always talk about. For me, that is what makes her so undeniable. Because when people say, oh, I don't, she's hard or this, and I'm like, yeah, because she's literally floating between two different experiences on the same page. And so...
And that puts the challenge that she is experiencing, that also puts that challenge on the reader.
Yes. And so to hear people read the things that matter to them, how different it was, but undeniably Toni Morrison, right? And there was so much to choose from. So one of the things that we did was we made sure we had a, you know, biography, and then we had a bibliography of all of her works. And so some people only knew one Toni Morrison book, and that was the one that was dog-eared and chewed up and, you know, it was written on, and that was what they brought. And other people were like, you know what? I came because I want to love her, but it's hard. You know, where do I start? I want to be around people who've read her work. So it was really a mix of people who came to listen and people who came to read. And then people who were inspired, who actually wrote pieces that inspired, that were inspired by her life.
Mariama and Glenn, you both visibly agreed when Natasha brought up not just her skill as a writer, but her skill as a writer working with specifically Black language. Can you talk to me about what that means to you, why it's important to you?
Well, for me, when so as I have attempted at times to write short fiction plays, dialogue is very difficult. And when Natasha mentioned how not only is Toni Morrison a master of the English language, but of Black language, that really is sometimes very difficult to translate. And so for her to be able to do that, there are so many times when I've read her work where I heard my grandmother, I heard my mother, or I heard myself, and I'm cracking up because she's captured it so precisely. And she does it in a way, like oftentimes, you know, when we talk about the history of literature, the canon, a lot of Black writers are writing in response to the white gaze. Oftentimes there's this inherent desire to be accepted by the mainstream. And she just plowed right through that. And that's courageous. That's fearless.
Mariama?
Yeah, I would add to that. It is the way in which she, the idiom of Black speech and the feeling of Black culture kind of come together in language that she creates. So to put those, to put that on a page mm-hmm. can be intimidating for some readers. And mm-hmm. so my personal experience coming to that was working primarily with teachers through something called Language Matters, which was a project that we developed, the project on history of Black writing developed in conjunction with the Toni Morrison Society when I served as president, because we wanted to talk about the difficulties of accessing Morrison's language. But what we came to understand was that she was giving language back to us.
Yeah.
And we have to have a way of communicating that language on the page. But she was giving language back to people.
That is a really profound statement. And I'm curious for you as a reader, did you personally experience that feeling?
Absolutely. And it continues. So all of us, of course, have our favorite books. But I was talking to both my colleagues earlier that right now, my favorite book is Home, because for 3 years I was remotely caregiving for my mother and driving to Georgia sometimes as often as twice a month. And that book had everything in it that came out of many of my experiences, my mother's experiences, my grandmother's experiences in Georgia.
You know, we invited all of our guests today to bring a passage to read from, and I see that you have Home in front of you.
I do.
This seems like a good time.
It's
Would you
a good
mind
time.
Reading the passage that you brought to share and just
yeah.
tell us what we need to know to understand it before you launch in?
Well, I mean, so that I wear two hats. The academic side of me, of course, came to know Morrison through a concept called literary archaeology. And so that's kind of the basis on which the project on History of Black Writing is founded. We are recovering writers who doing that deep dive into culture where people don't know. So we have a recovery project ongoing now for more than 35 years. But from Home, this is a passage. Some people who don't know this book, it's about a returning war veteran, Frank, and his sister C, or Cedra. Her name is, you know, spelled one of those created names that Black folk often do, like Mary Emma, two grandmothers. And so he's saving his sister, and he brings her back to Georgia, their home city, small rural town, and turns her over to women healers, Black women healers, no formal education, but extremely knowledgeable. And one of them, Miss Ethel, who is the principal healer, tells her after she's getting better and regaining her health. And by the way, this is one of those classic abusive situations by a white male doctor in relationship to a Black woman. So it's really about Black woman's health. And so she's, of course, down and out. C is the character, Frank's sister. And so Miss Ethel says, "See what I mean? Look at yourself. You're free. Nothing and nobody is obliged to save you but you. Seed your own land. You young and a woman, and there are serious limitations in both. But you a person, too. Don't let Lenore or some trifling boyfriend, and certainly no devil doctor, decide who you are. That's slavery. Somewhere inside you is that free person I'm talking about. Locate her and let her do some good in the world." So this is an older woman talking to a younger woman who has been abused medically, you know, violated in all kinds of ways. But these women bring her back to health and she returns home, which, of course, is the title of the book. So it's a beautiful story about how we take the worst and turn it into the best. And that is done within the community of Black folk.
But also when Natasha was talking earlier about the talking to that she felt was being delivered to her personally as the reader, if you just take that as a message that's not just to a character but to readers.
Exactly, exactly. And I mean, again, all over this book are passages that talk to us about who you got named after and you deserve to live up to the reputation of your name. I hear that all the time because I'm named after my two grandmothers. Mm-hmm. I heard it all my life. And it's like, you can't do wrong by them. We named you so-and-so. So these are the kinds of experiences that Morrison just draws from us.
Hold that thought. We have to take a break. Call 816-235-2888 to talk about the influence of Toni Morrison on you, whether it's in her writing or her example or both. 816-235-2888. And we just have a tiny bit of time. So do it now. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and the prolific Nobel Prize-winning novelist Toni Morrison died this month at the age of 88. As a community celebrates her life and grieves her loss, we've invited a few people who have been gathering her fans together for local events to share their perspectives on Toni Morrison's legacy. I'm here with poets Natasha Elskari and Glenn North, as well as KU English professor Mary Emma Graham. You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. And so we were just hearing a passage that means something really profound to Mary Emma. Natasha, what did you bring in?
I brought in the kind of like the foreword to her latest, The Source of Self-Regard, which was the selected essays, speeches, and meditations, which Toni Morrison was very giving with interviews. And I mean, she gave us so much. So regardless of how you enter, there's a space for you to enter, whether in the documentary came out this year. And so I started reading this book. I bought it the day that it came out and I started reading it on the plane. And this first essay, which is only about a page and a half, I read it 5 times.
You just couldn't even go to the next part because you just needed to stay with that.
That's how I read her, though. So when someone says, "I've read all 11 of her books," I'm like, "I'm impressed." Because I just keep rereading the same ones because I get something new each time. And this one, I chose this one, this passage, because I felt like she is that grandmother advice, the thing that you said, and the charge that she makes. And so to writers, "The thought that leads me to contemplate with dread the erasure of other voices, of unwritten novels, poems whispered or swallowed, for fear of being overheard by the wrong people, outlawed languages flourishing underground, essayists' questions challenging authority, never being posed, unstaged plays, canceled films, that thought is a nightmare. As though a whole universe is being described in invisible ink. Certain kinds of trauma visited on peoples are so deep, so cruel, that unlike money, unlike vengeance, and even unlike justice or rights or the goodwill of others, only writers can translate such trauma and turn sorrow into meaning, sharpening the moral imagination. A writer's life and work are not a gift to mankind. They are its necessity.
You know, Toni Morrison has spoken a lot about writing as a form of talking to herself. And I hear some of that in there, the sharpening of the moral imagination, just the work the writer is doing, the thought.
She wanted everyone to work. We were talking about that before. She wanted her readers to work. She wanted teachers who were teaching her to work. And she wants writers to work. She doesn't like laziness. And so, and I think that is a good thing. And so I immediately felt convicted through these words, like, hey, are you putting out your work, or are you sitting on it? Are you saying what you need to say? Because writers always have to do that. Writing is very solitary. We'll kind of, you know, keep holding things close to our heart. And sometimes it's like, no, we actually need to speak about these things and speak on these things in a way that only writers can, and that it can be creative. The information that comes to people doesn't just have to be political or an analysis or full of numbers, that the writers get the interior in the human side. And that is our job, is to remind people of humanity and to do so so creatively that they can't deny it.
Glenn, what did you bring in?
Well, you know, I was thinking when I got the phone call that you all were, or the email, I should say, that you all were having this interview, and I started going back through some of my work, and I had not realized how much of an impact she'd had on my writing and how much I had referenced her in poems and used phrases from her work in papers that I had written and things like that. But the writing or the book that she has that has been kind of like my guide star, kind of like
the one you
always
keep going
in my toolkit,
yeah.
Is called Playing in the Dark, Whiteness in the Literary Imagination. And she talks about it, how in the history of American literature, there has always been this Black presence that has been ignored or stereotyped or demonized, and how you can't look at the canon of American literature and deny the presence of Blackness, because all of those writers in some way were dealing with the Black presence in this country. And the quote from the book that I would like to share, she says, there seems to be a more or less tacit agreement among literary scholars that because American literature has been clearly the preserve of white male views, genius, and power, those views, genius, and power are without relationship to and removed from the overwhelming presence of Black people in the United States. This agreement is made about a population that preceded every American of renown and was, I have come to believe, one of the most furtively radical impinging forces on the country's literature. The contemplation of this Black presence is central to any understanding of our national literature and should not be permitted to hover at the margins of the literary imagination.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is something I'm so glad that you brought to the table here. You know, this idea of an American literary canon, mm-hmm. what we mean by that, mm-hmm. who's included in it, who's not, where Toni Morrison fits. I'd love to hear all of you speaking to that.
Well, I was just going to quickly say, for me, you know, being studying poetry in grad school, all of the poets that were championed, Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams, you know, particularly the modernists, and even some contemporary writers like Tony Hoagland, how they have presented Black people in their poems. And so the conversation I would have with professors and fellow students about my resistance to that, or my having an issue with that, and they're often being, well, you just have to remember that was the time they were living in, or you just have to remember certain things, kind of like giving them a pass. And so Toni Morrison equipped me to say things in response to that and to push back. And she gave me the information and the arsenal that I needed to be able to do so effectively.
Mariama?
Yeah, I think the rare thing that we have in Morrison is that she was not only doing the work, publishing the books, 12 novels, nonfiction, providing us with critical perspectives.
Right.
But she was also doggedly insisting that we've got this critical invisibility, this absence of a presence of Black people's work. And so in her own work, the site of memory, which is that essay from 1987, where she's saying we have a responsibility to imagine the lives that people lived, give it back to people, bring it to the fore, because the world proceeded based on our backs, but proceeded without us when we tell the story. So Marzen is creating both a critical canon and a literary canon, a model for writers, and a conversation for teachers to have among themselves and with their students. So for me, the outstanding thing is not so much fighting the canon wars, we've been doing that for a while now, but to make sure we understand that despite all of that, there is a breadth and depth of Black writing that exists. And Marzen right now has pushed it to the forefront in every way. We are remembering her now. So in life as in death, she will remind us of how you do your work, how you give it to people, and how you fight and struggle with people to access it in new ways. So I'm going to lay my hand with the teachers, because I think that they have the job of preserving this work, of teaching people how to read, encouraging people to read, you know, sustaining memory. So I think she really pushes the battle in a way that we now have to pay attention to.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of teachers, a friend of mine, a white friend who teaches writing at the college level, has expressed some humility about how little Toni Morrison she's read, and some regret about that. Right. And she says that despite being this very literary person, that she realizes that her not having read more Toni Morrison reflects whose voice she was taught to value when she first got into literature in school. So I'm curious how that kind of thought sits with you. I mean, clearly you do think that teachers have this obligation, but not just an obligation. Like, it's a matter of whether it's just part of the of literature or if it's some separate topic.
Well, I think that there's a kind of gatekeeping that was going on. Morrison's works have been banned. American Library Association, beginning with The Bluest Eye, because of the incest. So the gatekeeping does keep her books out of the classroom. But again, despite that, people are reading her. There are teachers, as I said, the advanced placement teachers get Morrison to the classroom mainly through Beloved. But there are other teachers. I give the example of Cardozo High School in Washington, D.C., where the longest reader of Morrison is a 10th grade high school teacher who's been reading her for 40 years. I look to him. He's now retired, when I want to have a discussion about Morrison, because nothing passed by him. He was giving it to his students. So there are people fighting that gatekeeping every day.
Can you share a gem from one of those conversations with him with all of us now?
Okay. The Bluest Eye was a book that we gave to about 500 students in Cardozo High School in Washington, D.C. These were not kids who were necessarily the most literate or the most advanced readers, but they were students who were curious about why a book would be called The Bluest Eye. How do black people get blue eyes? So the science teachers, the literature teachers, the reading teachers, the special ed teachers got together to talk about how that might be understood by their students. And so Morrison was really impressed by the fact that they did projects, they did visual programs, they did poetry. They were trying to struggle with the notion of how they could understand a book that talked about blue eyes for Black people. They did an exhibit. Morrison came to the exhibit. She was happy that this was the way in which she was entering the classroom, despite the gatekeeping. And so while I think your example is well taken, and people were resistant to including her, on the other hand, there were many, many, many people embracing her. And so we're grateful for that.
Yes. Mary Emma Graham, thank you so much for being here. And Glenn North, Natasha Elskari, thank you both as well.
Thank you.
Of course.
There is a Toni Morrison reading this Saturday from 4 to 6 at Kansas City's Black Archives of Mid-America, and that is a wrap. These conversations will be archived at kcur.org/centralstandard. If you want to share them with your friends who might have missed out, that's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we will check in with the editor of the Shawnee Mission Post about his community, but what's going on in your community? Tell us what we ought to be discussing on Twitter. We love talking with our listeners, and we want to include your voices. We're at KCUR CST. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell and Ann Knigendorf. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date is next. Stay with us.